Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink. A little later, Senator Marshall Bullock, the chair of the Legislative Black Caucus, will be joining us to talk about Martin Luther King Day and where he's going to be on this day. Joining us right now, though, is our friends from Grassroots Midwest, and we're going to be talking about the 2020 state house elections. The calendar has turned. It's now 2020. And so we got to check in here with our friends, Adrian Hemond and Scott Bean. Adrian, Scott, thanks for joining us for the podcast again.
Thanks a lot for having us.
Thanks.
All right, so I've got the big map here. Here's the what the districts look like for one more turn before the new redistricting commission gets in and does its handy work. Let's start with the general election, then we'll move down to the primaries where the contest will be decided in the primary. Because it's about control of the House. Right now, the Republicans have a 58-52 majority. Well, they will as soon as the Flint seat's taken care of, but 58-52. And as you guys are taking a look at how things are, what the seats are looking like with the last year of these maps, I'm going to start with you, Adrian. How are things looking for Democrats?
You know, Democrats have definitely got a majority play that they can make this time. It's a steep climb. There are some seats that they should win. There are some seats that are stretch goals for them. And then there are seats they need to defend. Democrats had a really good year in 2018, and so they hold some seats that Republicans have held for most of the time that this map has been in place. And Democrats are going to have to spend some time and treasure to defend those seats before they can really focus on offense. So I think that they have a chance to do it, but it's I wouldn't put it at a coin flip yet.
As you look at these districts and sort of figure out what's going to be what, are you assuming that we return back to a blue state on the presidential level? What assumptions, I guess, from the top of the ticket do you make, or do you do like a series?
We sort of look at it a couple of different ways. I try not to rely too much on the top of the ticket from a statewide basis. We really like to look at it district by district in terms of, you know, both how the president plays and how some of his potential general election opponents play there. There are certain areas of the state where the president is very popular, where Democrats need to compete. And then there are also some areas where he's very unpopular, where they need to compete. And that sort of goes into our analysis of each of these districts individually. You know, good examples of that are, you know, the Democrats are trying to compete for the 104th district, which is currently held by Larry Inman. President's very popular in Grand Traverse County, especially outside Traverse City and the Old Mission Peninsula. And so we factor that into our analysis. Conversely, Democrats need to hold House District 19, currently occupied by Lori Pahutsky, you know, centered on the city of Livonia. The president's pretty unpopular there, like in a lot of suburban bedroom communities. And so we factor that into our analysis as well.
Well, and I think John brings up a good point, because I saw recently Mark Grebner has upped his prediction on what turnout's going to be. Now he's talking up to 6 million potential people turning out for the 2020 election. And Scott, that's not good news for Republicans, is it?
No, especially in the suburbs, Oakland County, Western Wayne, Adrian just mentioned Representative Pahutsky. That's not good. Not good for Republicans to get that seat back.
All right, so let's start looking at the seats. And you mentioned Oakland County, Scott, and that's kind of where the focus is here for Republicans. What are their prospects as you see it in Oakland County, Adrian?
Well, I think the 38th and 39th districts are going to be targeted really heavily by Democrats as flip opportunities. I think those are their two best flip opportunities in Oakland County. You're also going to see them make a pretty strong play for House District 45 that's currently occupied by Mike Weber. He's obviously term limited. That's a little bit more of a stretch. Rochester and Rochester Hills are not known as strong bastions for the Democratic Party. The Democrats also have some defense to play there. You know, they did well in Oakland County last time. You know, State Representative Mari Manoogian is one of those that needs to be defended. Padma Kupa in 41 is another one that needs to be defended. So Oakland County is going to be a lot of the action on offense and defense for the Democrats.
The Democrats are also excited about their potential in the 43rd district with Andrea Schroeder, in the 46th with John Riley. Is that taking things a little, is that being overly optimistic? Scott, I'll ask you that one.
Yes, overly optimistic.
I mean, I think the Democrats are doing a smart thing with these seats. They're definitely stretch goals. Let's be clear about that. But my explanation for why this is smart is a joke from election night in 2006, the last time the Democrats flipped the House. The joke around the Democratic offsite was, who the hell's Mark Corvo? right?
Yeah,
but
right.
they had a strong recruit in a district they did not expect to take, and 2016 developed into a wave election. They had a strong candidate there who was working really hard, was probably under-resourced, but managed to surf that wave into the House of Representatives. So you have to recruit strong candidates in some of these stretch goal seats and hope that the top of the ticket carries you through, and that's what they're doing.
Okay, so they have potential plays here in Oakland County where the map is... Republicans aren't very optimistic about their chances in Oakland County, Scott. They still don't have a real candidate for Oakland County executive. I got to believe that they're really nervous. Mike Bouchard's pretty nervous. Do they have a candidate for treasurer or any of the other countywide posts?
Yeah, actually, a gentleman by the name of Joe Kent filed for Oakland County treasurer 2 weeks ago, week and a half ago.
Okay, he ran for the House not too long ago.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. And he's going to run for treasurer. He's from Lake Orion area.
So they do have the candidate for that, but no Oakland County executive candidate has stepped forward. You think it might be Mike Bouchard? He's not going to do it. Boy, they might have to get Rocky to run there.
They need a candidate. They were trying to recruit Ruth Johnson to do this. Ruth does not appear to be interested in doing that. It's a tough time to be recruiting for a countywide office in Oakland County. It's been a rough go the last couple of election cycles. The president's not popular in Oakland County. And like in a lot of different states, you know, this is suburban bedroom communities that are caught up in the realignment that's going on right now.
So other places where the Dems could get a seat pickup here, I'm looking at the 61st district, the Brant Iden seat. You're nodding your head, Scott.
Yeah, absolutely. Both caucus staff are probably going to be spending a lot of time in Portage later this year knocking doors.
We already see one of the candidates, the Republican candidate in that race, Adrian, is already doing ads. I keep getting banner ads on my websites for her.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Bronwyn Haltom's essentially a self-financer with family money between her and her husband. And she appears to be getting out early spending money. I think part of the reason for that is that everyone recognizes this is going to be a tough go for Republicans. You know, I mentioned just a moment ago these suburban communities that are caught up in the realignment that's going on in the electorate. Portage is a great example of that. Obviously, you know, that's not big a swath of suburbs as Oakland County is, but it's suburban Kalamazoo. They're bedroom communities, a lot of higher income professionals that tend to be more educated. And those people are fleeing the Republican Party in droves at the same time that the Republican Party is making real inroads with the rural white working class. This is going to be a tough one for the Republicans to hold.
Any other suburban seats that you guys seen as being in play for Democrats for a pickup?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that, you know, you look at those Oakland County seats, 38 and 39, potentially 45 where Mike Weber is term limited. You look at the 61st and, you know, that's four seats, which is what the Democrats need to get back into the majority. But 45 is a tough go. They should get 61. They'll probably get 38 and 39, and then you got to pick the fourth one up someplace really tough.
Like maybe the 104th? I mean, what's that next tier? What do they have to win to get a majority?
On the happy assumption for Democrats that they're able to take 61, take 38, and take 39, then you either need 45, the Rochester Hills district in northern Oakland County, or you need 104, which I think is a real stretch without Larry Inman on the ballot, or, you know, you need one of these surprise seats, you know, maybe a 43 in Oakland County, someplace like that. But it's a tough map. You know, Democrats had a really good year in 2018. There aren't that many competitive or potentially competitive seats left out there.
All right, so let's talk about seats where Republicans could possibly have a pickup. Do they have some opportunities, Scott?
Maybe. Livonia, 19, the Pahutsky seat. That's probably the closest.
What about the Cheryl Kennedy seat, the 48th district?
Maybe.
I mean, they do have a good candidate there.
Yeah, again, it's going to be about good candidates in all of the districts and if they can raise money.
Anything in, what about Calhoun County? Aren't demographics kind of going the Democrats' way there?
Yeah, I mean, the 62nd district is tough to get back from Jim Hadsma, but that's a possibility that they could play there. You know, I do want to return to the 48th that you just mentioned. Cheryl Kennedy's a strong candidate, but this is the sort of inverse of what we were talking about with some of these more affluent suburbs in Metro Detroit or suburban Kalamazoo. This district's been trending away from Democrats for a little while. The president in particular is pretty popular in this district. You know, you've got some of those white working class union members, outside the city of Flint. That's been a good demographic for Republicans, and you've seen that in the last two elections. Pam Ferris got a run for her money in her last reelection effort. And, you know, this district was closer than probably it should have been in Representative Kennedy's first election because it's trending a little bit more towards Republicans. So I don't expect Republicans to flip this seat, but I expect them to perform pretty credibly.
It sounds like on the balance, if you're a Democrat, you're definitely feeling much more optimistic than if you're a Republican.
I think that's right, but I guess it depends on, you know, how you're framing your optimism. I mean, right now I'd give the Democrats, you know, maybe one chance in four to flip the House, but I expect them to pick up seats. So, I mean, if you're defining optimism as we're going to pick up seats, then yes, absolutely. If you're defining optimism as, you know, we've got this majority play locked up, tap the brakes.
Sounds like it's pretty reasonable to expect a 56-54 ending, right?
One way or another. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, being a fan of chaos, I'm rooting for 55-55, not going to lie, because that's great for business. But
hey, shared power was a lot of fun. From an observer's perspective and a journalist's perspective, I wouldn't mind seeing split power.
I don't have to work in the Capitol building anymore, so 55-55 sounds great. I apologize to all of my friends who still work in that building.
Well, let's talk about the Democratic nominee for president, whoever that might be. Is one better than the other as far as picking up seats? Adrian?
I think so. You know, I think Biden's probably your best shot in terms of seat pickups here. You know, and I think probably of the major candidates left in the field, I think Elizabeth Warren is probably your worst. And the other candidates fall somewhere in the middle there.
Are you counting Bloomberg in that calculus too?
Bloomberg is such a wild card here. It remains to be seen how much momentum he can generate. Obviously, he's not getting on the debate stage, as awful as those debates have been to watch. And he's not even really trying to get on the debate stage based on the rules as they are right now. He's just spending money. And from a political consultant's perspective, this is awesome, right? And I hope that former Mayor Bloomberg is successful, because I'd really like to test this proposition that you can just straight up buy a nomination, buy an election like this. That's great for business from our perspective. So I wish him all the best.
I got to ask, I know you're primarily focused at the legislative level, but give me your reaction to John James and Gary Peters. James isn't going to have a primary opponent. It looks like he's going to be pretty well funded, very popular. Is it going to be any different, or is the outcome of the presidential year going to kind of...
It remains to be seen. Gary Peters doesn't have great name ID. There's been a great deal of polling out there that demonstrates that. I don't know that a John James candidacy is going to be any more successful this time than it was the last time, partly because John James has tied his brand, rightly or wrongly, so closely to the president that I think if turnout is anything like what you referenced, Mark Grebner's predictions being like, that's bad for John James. I expect that Senator Peters will prevail there. But a lot of that really depends on how high turnout runs and, you know, how well the president does.
Scott, I wanted to ask you about Northern Michigan. Is there any seats here? And as I'm looking at the map, let's define Northern Michigan as anything north of M10 here. Is there any seats here outside of maybe Larry Inman that the Democrats have a shot at? I'm looking at maybe the 98th district, the candidate there.
Other than Grand Traverse County, Midland County, although, you know, the Democrats, they take a poke at it every once in a while. And it never has really worked out, but maybe.
Well, and the reason why I ask that, too, I mean, obviously the candidate in the 98th district, Sarah Schultz, is back at it. She was very aggressive in 2018. I thought gave Annette Glenn a pretty good run, is going to be at it again. But then I go over to the 99th, which seems to be the quicksand for Democrats. They always are looking at that 99th district, and they're like, if only these Central Michigan students would vote. And what if Bernie Sanders was the nominee? Does that encourage these Central Michigan voters to finally vote and get a Democrat in there?
No. It does not.
Okay. You just burst my bubble here.
No, 99, this is, for the last decade, this has been Lucy, Charlie Brown, and the football. The Democrats keep kicking at it, and the football's never there when your leg's extended.
More than a decade.
I mean, I remember going up and knocking doors for Sandy Call and then her husband, and election night returns would come in, and there was no problem.
Yeah, I mean, the Democrats took a strong couple of runs at this with Brian Mielke, which was probably as good a candidate as they could find for this district. Really remedied some of the mistakes they'd made in candidate recruitment in prior years. If they couldn't flip it with Brian Mielke, that one's not on my list.
Okay, what about Southwest Michigan then? Because this Fred Upton race with John Hoadley in the 6th Congressional District, that could get really competitive. And obviously the Democrats think that they have a pickup opportunity there. Is there any carryover in the State House District if John Hoadley is able to get momentum and a Democrat wins that 6th Congressional District?
I'm very skeptical, you know, other than the seat we already mentioned, the 61st. You know, Van Buren County is sort of weird. There's some Democrats there. The county party's been kind of a mess for 20 years. You know, the city of Benton Harbor doesn't really turn out, which is a shame for Democrats. Almost a decade ago when John Prose was running House elections there, he would win the city of Benton Harbor, which is shocking. So, I mean, the part of the problem for Democrats in Southwest Michigan is that the county party organizations have been a mess for decades. And so there's not really a farm team, and there's not really a local organization to churn out your voters. I'm not saying that this is impossible. And I mean, if we have a wave election, which I don't expect, then certainly something could get brought along there. But Democrats should not be pinning their hopes on Southwest Michigan right now.
Let's talk about primaries then, because obviously we're going to have several open seats. We've got at least 26 open seats. What primaries are you looking at, Adrian? And then I'll tell you the primary I'm most interested in.
Well, so there are going to be a bunch of Southeast Michigan safe seat Dem primaries, a few of them touching the city of Detroit, either in whole and in part. Wendell Byrd is term limited from office. And, of course, former gubernatorial candidate Sri Tanadar is running there, which should be interesting. Representative Garrett's also term limited. Sherry Gay Dagnogo is also term limited. Leslie Love. So it'll be a lot of political competition in the city of Detroit for some of these House seats. And then, you know, you've got on the Republican side, there are also some open seats that I think are pretty interesting. You know, on the lean GOP side, obviously we mentioned the Weber and Inman seats. Those, at least at the beginning of the decade, we had on about a +8 GOP base. Obviously, those are getting closer. There are some interesting safe seat Republican primaries out there as well. Lynn Afendoulis is obviously not term limited, but is chosen to give up her seat to run for Congress, which creates an early opening in the 73rd in suburban Grand Rapids. Same thing with Shane Hernandez up in the Thumb, who's dipping out early to run for Congressman Paul Mitchell's seat, which creates another early vacancy. And then, of course, you know, the Speaker is term limited, as is the floor leader Tristan Cole up in northern Michigan in 105 and in 107. So I'll be keeping a close eye on those ones as well, especially because they're in the same media market as the Larry Inman scandal, and so that may play some part in the primary in terms of the issues that are being talked about.
Scott, which ones are you focused on?
It's always fun to watch crowded primaries and what happens. Aaron Miller's seat is open up down in along the Indiana border. The Speaker's seat will have a crowded primary.
Interestingly, the Speaker has not anointed a potential successor there. I expect him to do so. Lee Chatfield's not going anywhere. He's term limited from office. But I think most political observers expect Lee to be hanging around as a candidate for something in the future. So I'll be really interested to see who the Speaker picks as his potential successor there.
All right. So I'm going to tell you which ones I'm most excited about. The first one is the one you mentioned first, the Sri Tanadar candidacy in the 3rd State House District.
Everybody's smiling and looking at me. I don't understand why.
Sri, baby. I mean, Sri is back, and he's running for the House. The only thing better would have been if Abdul El-Sayed had decided he was going to run, too.
I've been disappointing a lot of national reporters who've been calling, expecting me to start mixing it up with Sri again after all the shots I took at him in the Dem gubernatorial primary, and they've all been disappointed. I expect Sri's going to win.
Do you?
I mentioned earlier testing this hypothesis that you can buy a nomination at the presidential level. We've already tested that hypothesis extensively at the state representative level. Sri's got the money. He's going to win.
Now, the other district I was really interested in was the 55th House District, because it seemed like we had two heavy hitters who had already raised a substantial amount of money who were going to go at it in the Democratic primary. The 55th is the Rebecca Warren seat there in Washtenaw County. Felicia Brabick is in, but Adrian, the other candidate looks like she is not going to run now.
Yeah, that's right. Mandy Graywall had filed for this seat. She's the township supervisor in Pittsfield Township, which is a big bedroom community just outside of Ann Arbor. She had filed for the seat. She had a boatload of money in the bank and decided before the first of the year that she was not going to run for the seat, which unless somebody pretty high quality gets in here, gives Felicia Brabeck, who's the county commissioner from Pittsfield Township, a clear shot through this primary in a plus 18 D seat, which means, you know, that she should be walking into the legislature in January next year.
That's interesting because that was the seat that Abdul El-Sayed lives in. And had there maybe not been a top-tier candidate there, maybe we could have seen him run as state representative too. And then the other district I just want to flag, the 105th district, I think you guys mentioned it, Ken Borton against Tony Cutler. I only mention that because they're both big names in northern Michigan, but they're from different parts of the district. And so we could see a little chip-chopping of the vote, a little regional politics there, Scott.
Yeah, sure. And probably it's going to depend on who can raise some money up there to get the message out. That district is very, very large and spread across, what, to five counties?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's going to be who can get the message out.
Okay, so last question here before we go ahead and go to our interview with Marshall Bullock. The most expensive seat. Now, as you guys are looking at this, we mentioned the 61st district. That could be the most expensive seat. Is there another one we haven't mentioned that could put in a lot of money, Adrian?
Yeah, the 61st is a great pick. I expect the 71st will be the most expensive seat.
The 71st with Angela Whitwer.
Absolutely. The Republicans are coming hard for this seat. The president polls pretty well in Eaton County outside of Delta Township and to some extent Grand Ledge. The rest of Eaton County is kind of Trump country. Obviously, it's the exact opposite in Delta Township and Grand Ledge. I think a lot depends on who comes through that Republican primary, but Republicans feel like they've got a good shot at this district. Former State Senator Rick Jones is running for sheriff in Eaton County, so you're going to have a contested sheriff race. He's running against the incumbent, Tom Reich, and so there's going to be a lot going on in Eaton County. It's going to take a lot of money to break through the noise with a sheriff's race going on, the U.S. Senate race, the presidency. So I expect that that one will probably edge out the 61st.
And that's got Christine Barnes. She's going to make another run at it, but she's got a primary against Gina Johnson, who is a staffer for Patrick Kolbeck or a supporter of Patrick Kolbeck.
Yeah, that's right. And it'll be very interesting to see, is this going to be a Republican primary where the institutional Republican Party matters the most, or is it going to be one where sort of ideology matters the most? If it's an ideological contest, then you probably put your money on Gina Johnson because she's, you know, significantly to the right of Christine Barnes, who's pretty conservative. But I think it really depends on how much party organization matters here.
Adrian Heeman, Scott Bean from Grassroots Midwest, thanks for coming in and talking about the big map here with us.
Thanks so much. Thanks.
We're joined now by State Senator Marshall Bullock. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
How you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you. So are you officially now the chair of the Legislative Black Caucus?
Yes, I am officially the chair of the Michigan Legislative Black Caucus, and I took the helm in December We had a great meeting, and then was it this week? Actually, we held our first meeting of the year. We made sure that we had to fill a few positions, so we elected our new second vice chair, which is Rep. Sarah Anthony. And then we are formulating what our priorities will be for 2020, and we will be retreating as a group to bond and do those type of things. And we have a Black History program coming up in February here at the Capitol in the Rotunda. And this year, last year, we highlighted African-American judges and those in the judiciary. This year, we will be highlighting African-American farmers and agriculture in the state of Michigan.
Wow, I didn't know that there was a history component there. What are some of the things that you guys would like to folks to know about that?
Well, the first thing is, once we were emancipated, African Americans were naturally the farmers, the folks that took care of the land, and we got land at that time. And so the system, Jim Crow laws, slowly deteriorated the land ownership of African Americans who were farmers and selling produce, and the land either was dwindled or cut up through these laws, the oppression and segregation of the United States. And so it was actually the disintegration of Black wealth.
How did that play here in Michigan? Were African Americans allowed to own property and farm land here?
Well, they own land here. And again, so depending on what era that was, that someone came and purchased the land, especially folks that moved north and started working and had a few dollars. And that's what you do. You purchase land. And so just in southeast Michigan, I think you had a lot of farmers in the Romulus, Sumter Township, Belleville area, but plenty of places throughout the state, maybe in the lower half where African-American owned. We still have some Black farmers. We all actually have plenty urban farmers out of the city of Detroit. D-Town Farms is ran by Malik Yakini, and that whole thing was about generational wealth and the African-American producing their own produce and selling within their own community.
How much have you experienced that in the city of Detroit? Because I know that those in-city farms are becoming a little in vogue. What have you seen in the city in regards to that?
So working with the city, I mean, we have those folks that have a dedicated mission, like Malik Yakini. There are some other farms. I believe there are the Oakland Farms, the Michigan United Farming Industry, codenamed Muffy, but they had a lot of complications with the city. They're not actually owned by African Americans. So
what's grown? What are some things that are grown in the city?
Oh, they're growing all kinds of produce. Most of them sell their produce, whether it's tomatoes and vegetables and things like that. As we've studied this issue, as we're going to be highlighting them, we're preparing for the African Americans who are going to be cultivating the cannabis. So that's going
right,
to be the
I'm
new
sure.
industry. So,
right.
But in Detroit, that's, you know, folks are selling, and then they have some competing factions who are have farms, but they're giving their produce away for free. So there's a different motive there. I don't know with, you know, I can't say someone has a hidden agenda, but there's a different motive where folks are doing it as a way of life and a means of life. So if someone moves next door and you're selling ice cream and now they open a shop and they're giving away ice cream for free, they're messing up the program, so to speak. And then there are some other issues with who's buying the property and tilling in a neighborhood that may be predominantly Black. That's just one facet of this thing. So we look at all of these issues as a Michigan Legislative Black Caucus, and myself just being a Detroiter and coming out of the city administration.
Who would think that there would be some kind of internal issues like this when you're dealing with taking vacant land and then just farming it, as we've been doing in this state for at least a century and a half?
Well, yeah, but not in the urban community. Like, you know, where it used to be, you know, blocks and blocks of thriving communities and homes, and due to many different variables of why a neighborhood is now blighted, and so, you know, houses get knocked down, and someone decides they're going to buy 10 lots and start farming in the middle, you know, next door to my grandmother. That's sort of a problem for the community, so to speak. It's a good use of land, so to, you know, there's an argument for both sides, but when you go into the community and you disrupt it with this thing, you know.
So why would the community not like it? They don't like the smell of the manure, the fertilizer?
No, well, there's always inherent behavior. So you come in, someone who's not an African American buys 5-10 plots of land in the middle of an African American neighborhood, and all of a sudden they're farming. you know, that's what is perceived as the first steps of racial gentrification.
That
issue, so that's just one facet of that stuff. Yeah. So those are things that you have to be mindful of. And even if you are an outsider coming into someone's community, you have to have a conversation with them. Buying a house is one thing, but when you start buying land and you decide that you're going to use it in a different purpose than what the neighborhood is purpose for. Mm-hmm. A residential neighborhood is residential.
Well, yeah, because it would seem like that'd be a zoning issue, right?
So, yeah. Detroit went through some struggles, as well as other communities that are having this issue with blight and what to do with the land and who's coming in, who's buying, what speculators are buying the land. Is it a long-term money grab? There are a whole lot of unintended consequences, even for someone who's trying to just do something good, so mm-hmm. whether they're black or white. So
we are taping on Thursday, but we are publishing this on MLK Day on Monday. So on Monday, you're going to be where?
My fraternity, Omega Psi Phi Fraternity, Southfield Chapter Tau Kappa Kappa, participates at Hope United out of Southfield on Northwestern Highway at Losser. And for 35 years, they have been doing a Martin Luther King Day march from the church down Civic Center Drive to the Southfield Pavilion on Evergreen at Civic Center Drive, and hosting one of the largest Martin Luther King celebrations in the state. It's been ongoing, and what we do as a vendor and a fraternity is we provide hot chocolate, because it's pretty cold generally. And so we're a hit, and we talk about what Omega Psi Phi is. We were founded at an all-black university, one of the historic black college or universities, at Howard University, November 17th, 1911.
My understanding is this may be the first Martin Luther King Day march in the country.
So for 35 years, they've been doing it here. Definitely in Michigan, it's been a major part of that institution, and that's why, as a Southfield chapter, we continue to participate.
How many people do you expect at something like that?
I would be remiss giving you a number, but there are hundreds of people, if not close to 1,000, that partake. So the march is usually several hundred people marching, mm-hmm. especially, you know, if the weather is not frigid. And then the entire Southfield Civic Pavilion is full. There's no empty seat at this program.
Wow. And so how much hot chocolate you got to make for that?
We just continue to give it out till we run out. Yeah, so we make sure we're fully stocked. We've never run out.
When people approach you and ask you, what should we be doing for Martin Luther King Day? What do you tell them? What does the day mean for you?
Well, it's a day of reflection. I was born in 1967, so I never got to see any of the speeches, but his death and the speeches were still at the frontal lobe of all of my family members and friends and the folks who were influential in my life as I was raised up. So going into the 70s, I was born just 19 days before the Detroit riots. So I was born on the 4th of July, and I think it started on the 23rd or something. My family lived in the North End and off Claremont and 12th Street. So the riots, Martin Luther King, and those stories were taught to us, if not in school, but just family passing down the stories and what racism is and what segregation was. We were filled with all of that knowledge and how to navigate life. And so I think MLK Day today, even though we've made many strides, we've had an African-American president, as you can see, over the last 4 years. Although we've gained a lot as an African-American community in the nation, but there are still some hurdles and still some folks that wish that these things hadn't happened. And so we still have to maintain some civility with dignity and move forward in a manner that is still just and righteous.
So being somebody who's grown up in Detroit and obviously live there now, represent the 4th District in the city of Detroit, give me your assessment on how that city is, if it's growing, or the population that is coming in now, because it seems like, particularly in the downtown area, you're getting some new types of housing and development there. What's kind of your perception on how that's coming along?
I probably have a different perception. So we got to look at it historically. There was a migration out of Detroit, first the white flight, which took many, many years. Mm-hmm. And then as Detroit became probably the most populated black city in the country, the city's designed for 2.3 million, but we had well over 1.7, 1.8 million with a 80, 90% population of African Americans. Through the years, as the city and the migration took place, what we still call it white flight, when the department stores and things left downtown, it kind of left a black hole in the city. And those that stayed managed and worked hard. You know, the auto industry created the middle class, not just for African Americans, but for the country, especially here in Detroit in the Midwest. There was a second flight, which was black flight, especially after the state constitution was changed under a previous administration that disrupted what was called residency. So the state constitution was signed in by Engler that you no longer could mandate someone be a resident of a city to be employed by that city. So outside of the auto industry, the city of Detroit is the largest employer. When you made it eligible for folks to live outside of the city and be employed, so folks started moving out, and there was a black flight. And so then we have the foreclosure crisis. And so there are many different variables, the school system being disenfranchised for many, many years, and folks wanted their kids to go to what they perceived as a very strict and rigid school out in the suburbs that was going to give their kids a better opportunity because we had took flight. So our schools now had folks that were able left or went to a suburban school. Now you left the inner city schools defunct to be riddled with problems. You know, their funding, teachers aren't getting paid the same and things like that. And so now you got problematic kids. And then another thing that happened was the disintegration of behavioral health facilities and juvenile justice sites in the state of Michigan in the 90s also, which then kind of mainstreamed those kids with behavioral health issues back into the school system instead of going somewhere where they needed proper treatment. And then also those behavioral health students or behavioral health individuals then filled the juvenile justice system and the penitentiary system, the Department of Corrections, and no one was equipped. And so we had all these little chaotic bombs going off. And so you look at it 20 years later, you got city went through bankruptcy, there's a new mayor, and you're trying to fight blight, you're trying to fight this racial disharmony, and so we're trying to populate the city. And if you look at the racial word of gentrification, that means they clear out a neighborhood or they clear out a community of one neighbor, and then when they rebuild, the folks that live there are no longer able to afford to live there, and folks that don't look like them. Well, Detroit has a different, I don't know how to define it, I don't think that gentrification can be used as a bad word all the time. You still have to grow. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to live in this impoverished neighborhood. Folks need to rehabilitate their homes. We need more businesses. We need more small businesses. We need more African-American participation and minority participation. So what we have now is what I would consider, folks are moving in where there are neighborhoods with availability. Mm. And it's not necessarily the same thing. There is a perception of the investment that's going on, that the African American community is not involved at the same rate as other counterparts, like a Dan Gilbert who bought, 100 buildings, but he now has businesses downtown, and those folks are looking for housing, and so there are a few housing complexes that were put up, but they didn't move anybody out technically to mm-hmm. build these new housing units, and that's downtown. But downtown, you need a thriving downtown to be the heartbeat of your city in order to send the blood to other parts of the city. So, and you can only do that a neighborhood at a time. There is no magic wand where you can fix all the problems at one time. So there's a strategic solution and strategy to how to rebuild it neighborhood by neighborhood. But you can't just rebuild the entire city at one time. And it's almost reverse engineering. Most folks think you should go to the worst neighborhood and start there. But if you spend all your money in the worst neighborhood, then the good neighborhoods start looking like that neighborhood, and you're chasing your tail. Yeah. So actually what you have to do is start in a populated neighborhood and spend less money making sure you maintain the populated neighborhood, and go to the next set populated neighborhood and work your way backwards. Okay. And so that's how you do it effectively and cost efficiently. You know, if you had a $1 million and you went to a neighborhood that had 1,000 homes and 500 of those homes were empty, half the neighborhood's already empty, and let's say 300 of those homes were so in such bad shape they needed to be demolished, you can spend your $1 million knocking down only a half of that, and you still neglected the rest of the city. Or you can go to a populated neighborhood, same 1,000 homes, but 900 are occupied, 100 are empty, 50 need to be, maybe 25, 30 need to be demolished. You can spend a portion of that money, knock those houses down, rebuild that neighborhood, bring the comps up, make everybody happy. Mm-hmm. Go to another neighborhood like that, and you can save more neighborhoods in that manner than you could with that money.
That makes a lot of sense.
Than you could by spending all of your money in one or two of the most depleted neighborhoods, and no one would know. And then those neighborhoods that we that are populated would then slowly deteriorate and turn into those neighborhoods.
One last question here before I let you go. Mayor Mike Duggan, his term is up in 2021. Do you expect him to run again, and would you support him if he were?
Well, yeah, I would. I mean, I worked for him for 6 years. I think that 2 to 3 terms is probably the limit for anybody. I know Coleman Young did 5 or 20 years, but I think 8 to 12 years is enough time to accomplish what it is that your vision to do what it is. And if you get the city in a good place, then you step aside and let the next motivated individual hopefully take what you've done and move forward. And the odds is, I mean, in Detroit it's pretty safe. You're going to have a Democrat being the mayor, whether it's African-American or non or female or male. So you're going to have a Democrat right in the helm. And hopefully they can take the good things from the previous administration, continue to build on them, and if they have some new strategies or new ideas on how to move forward. But right now, Mayor Duggan has put Detroit in a great space. Not just locally, but worldwide. I mean, Michigan and Detroit, through the bankruptcy, we were on life support. And Detroit, you know, it's like anything else. You have a stroke or something or a heart attack, and you got to take care of yourself and eat better and exercise right. And so our pulse is beating, and the rest of the state is starting to beat again. We got a Democrat as governor, and so let's see how we can take care of ourselves and last a little longer at this.
Senator Marshall Bullock, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
All right, no problem.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Senator Bullock, Scott Bean, Adrian Heeman, and the boss, John Roehring. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.